Good afternoon. I am delighted to introduce the 2011 McCorkle Lecturer, Judge Michael Boudin of the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. The McCorkle Lecture honors the memory of Claiborne Ross McCorkle, who graduated from the law school in 1910 and had a distinguished career as a practitioner in Southwest Virginia. I'm delighted to see in the audience Claiborne's great-grandniece, Frances McCorkle, who is a second-year law student. Even by the standards of a federal judge, Michael Boudin has had a career of remarkable accomplishment. He graduated from Harvard College and Harvard Law School and was the president of the Harvard Law Review. He then obtained two of the most desirable clerkships available at that time for Judge Henry Friendly and Justice John Harlan. He became a close friend of Judge Friendly, accompanying him and his wife on vacations, and was named literary executor in Friendly's will. His lecture today is based on a chapter of his projected biography of Judge Friendly, and indeed previous chapters have already been published in the NYU and Penn Law Reviews. Boudin joined the law firm of Covington and Burling after his clerkships. His mentor there was Hugh Cox, arguably the leading appellate advocate at that firm. Now, the students in the audience will no doubt be amazed that law firms at that time had the barbaric practice of making associates share offices. Boudin's office mate was Dick Merrill, who would of course later join the Virginia faculty and become its dean. Boudin specialized in appellate advocacy with an emphasis on regulatory cases. By the time another of my colleagues, Paul Stephen, came to Covington and Burling in the mid-1970s, Boudin was widely considered the most brilliant lawyer in Washington. His memos were circulated to young associates at the firm as the standard to which they should aspire. Boudin left Covington and Burling in 1987 to join the Justice Department as Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust. In 1990, President Bush appointed him to the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. He resigned 2 years later to move to Boston to be with his wife, Professor Martha Field of Harvard Law School. In 1992, however, President Bush nominated him to the First Circuit after Judge Levin Campbell took senior status. The Senate confirmed the nomination in spite of the general freeze on Bush judicial nominations that began once the president's reelection began to appear doubtful. The fact of his confirmation demonstrates the widespread and bipartisan admiration for Boudin's intellect and lawyerly skills. Judge Boudin served as the Chief Judge of the First Circuit from 2001 to 2008. He has also taught regularly at Harvard Law School, mostly antitrust, but sometimes evidence. Judge Boudin is equally at home in the world of ideas and the world of human beings. To those who know him, including several members of our faculty, he is as famed for his decency and kindness as for his brilliance. We're honored to have him with us today. Please join me in welcoming Judge Michael Boudin.
So my thanks, first of all, to the dean, to Professors White and Abraham, who proposed the talk, and to the members of the law school, who faculty, who were good enough to invite me. This school is one I've admired and visited ever since 40 years ago. My one-time Covington roommate, Dick Merrill, and his wife, Lissa, would entertain me at dinners, and I've come to love the school. This is also a chance for me to appease, once again, the shade of my mentor, Henry Friendly, who once grumbled of a puff piece tribute I had written in his honor for some symposium. Not much substance there, Mike. So let us begin. Our legal culture takes for granted the dissent as a kind of natural companion to the court's majority opinion. But this is a parochial view of the British tradition in the early years was divided in the House of Lords and the Privy Council, both courts of a sort. Dissents were publication of dissents was forbidden. Today there are some continental countries where dissents are disallowed. In this country, John Marshall was famous for doing his best to insist on unanimous opinions. And in 1924, an ABA judicial ethics canon decried dissents as undermining faith in the courts. But the dissents have a capacity to reveal an individual judge in a way that panel decisions really do not. The judge writing only for himself, capable of using a personal voice, ranging rather more widely, can often give an emphasis to themes that, against the background of a full-scale opinion for the court, might not emerge as so important to the judge. Henry Friendly is reckoned to be one of the greatest federal judges to sit in the last century. He had, by common consent, no circuit court peer other than Learned Hand, and in a circuit where there are no portraits of judges, there are two busts in the courtroom, one of Hand and one of Friendly. Friendly wrote many dissents. Almost all of them were full-scale opinions. They were all reflected his customary skill and learning. A measuring rod may be helpful. During his almost 26 years on the bench, from September 1959 to March in 1986, Friendly wrote somewhat over 800 full-scale published opinions for the panel. But he also wrote about 103 dissents and I think about 88 concurrences, which were sometimes concurrences in part. And of course, one can, it's easy to do in this talk, regard them all as dissents of a sort, because in general, he didn't just add more reasons for the majority's result. Indeed, he rarely did that. He was usually expressing, even in decisions that began as concurrences and joined the judgment of the court, a somewhat different rationale for the result, often in disagreement with the majority. And of course, the different rationale would have it produce a different outcome on other sets of facts. So to that degree, it really was a dissent. If you treat the concurrences and dissents and partial concurrences together, there are about 200 opinions. Now, this may seem modest as a percentage of the 2,800 panel cases on which he sat over the course of 25 years, of writing only a third or a little less. But it's a significantly higher percentage when one runs the math through Westlaw or some other database than other judges, I think closer to 6% than 3 being, in general, what his colleagues turned out. And his separate opinions, if you take 200 as against 800, are really 20% of his major opinions. So they comprise a substantial body of work, invite a critique, and that is the subject today. One has to start by recalling Friendly's truly extraordinary, almost unparalleled career. His astounding A double plus average. It was actually a shade higher. An A plus average being the grade for a summa degree, which was itself rarely awarded at Harvard in those days. And so he was a full grade plus another point or so higher than a summa. He clerked for Justice Brandeis. He then went as a kind of apprentice to John Harlan, among others, to the Root Clark firm in New York. And then he left the firm to co-found the Cleary Gottlieb firm in 1946. And then simultaneously served thereafter, both as a partner, a founding partner doing a lot of management at Cleary, with the full-time job of being general counsel and vice president of Pan American World Airways, a small client that he had nursed into something much more substantial. No one here needs any reminding of his really heroic scholarship, the books, the articles, the book reviews, the lectures, all done in his spare time as a busy judge. The court, when he joined it in 1959, was past this golden period in which it was presided over by the two hands, Augustus and Learned, by Charles Clark, by Thomas Swan, Jerome Frank. Only L. Hand remained, and he overlapped only very briefly with Friendly. But the court was beginning to grow, and during Friendly's tenure, he had about 17 colleagues as the size of the court enlarged. Many were very able judges, and to mention only two among them, Ralph Winter and Jim Oakes, serves to underline that Friendly was very much in the middle of the court in terms of judicial politics, a rather loose idea which nevertheless conveys something to lawyers. So it may be worth asking, among other questions, why 200 times Friendly was unable to persuade at least one colleague to switch sides and join Friendly's position. But it's well to say a good deal first, or something first, about other important matters. Friendly's approach to legal issues, the style and substance of the dissents, what we can learn about from them about his priorities, priorities which were prompting him to take the trouble of writing separate opinions. And then finally, we ought to ask about his influence and the importance of his dissents. Now, all of Friendly's opinions, whether for the panel or for himself, flowed from a common conception about judging. Given his education and his experience, he certainly was not under any illusion that judicial decisions are the impersonal voice of the oracle, or even the companion belief that a judicial issue has only one right solution. Such beliefs were, of course, being attacked by the realists, as Friendly was a young lawyer. But in some ways, Friendly's own views were closer to the so-called legal process school than gaining ground in major law schools in the 40s and 50s. But he really didn't fit very neatly into any camp, and he wasn't especially interested in philosophy of judging, though he was interested in practically everything else. Legal process, as you know, is essentially a perspective which takes the view that judging is a process by which certain accepted materials, when subject to certain accepted techniques, will produce answers, or in closer cases, at least provide some degree of guidance and structure for the process of deciding cases. Although its heyday was perhaps the 50s and the 60s, well after Friendly's time at law school, it may still be the hidden armature of thinking that lies below the surface in most first-year law school classes. But however that may be, certainly it's the way most judges think that they are doing their job. And the perspective probably corresponds to how most judges do try to do it. There are rare exceptions. This has the technique itself has, I think, a special grip on judges who do it extremely well. But there are exceptions, say William O. Douglas, who could have done it if he wanted to. Friendly certainly was wonderful at the technique, and he enjoyed exercising it. So a word then about the character of Friendly's descents. All of his opinions were formidable, but in the case of the descents, the word devastating comes swiftly to mind. The measured self-restraint of, say, John Harlan, who had been Friendly's partner at Root Clark, and who was sitting on the Supreme Court and dissenting with great regularity in the period that Friendly was a judge, was entirely foreign to Friendly. With him, the mildly biting comment about the majority opinion is very common. And showing that they stung often, from time to time, not the author of the panel opinion, but a concurring judge would feel moved, particularly John Newman, to write a separate defense of the majority opinion in response to Friendly's attacks. So effective were they. But tone was the least of the panel's problems when Friendly entered on a dissent. He had an enormous knowledge of common law doctrine, bolstered by his own career at Harvard College as a prize-winning historian. John Roberts won the same prize, apparently, some years later. Friendly was equally deft in statutory construction. One of his famous articles, nominally about Frankfurter, is essentially about techniques of construction. His fertility of mind to furnish arguments and citations and ideas completely unknown to counsel who were handling the case. But if there is any area in which his intensity and analytical power showed itself more than others, it was in handling of precedents. Consider this piece of a vivisection in a dissent directed to the precedents relied on by the panel majority. It will help to understand that the panel had invoked in support of the plurality of the majority opinion a concurring opinion of the Supreme Court in a case called Rhodes, and then it had invoked a prior decision of the Second Circuit itself in a case called LaRue. Friendly countered these citations as follows. We should look for guidance to the majority opinion in Rhodes, representing the views of six justices, rather than, as the majority here does, to the concurring opinion, which represents the views of only three. Nor should the panel be relying on our own opinion in LaRue, a portion of which relied on a Sixth Circuit decision that was itself reversed by the Supreme Court only a fortnight after LaRue was decided. Along with his legal skills, he was also formidably able in absorbing at high speed by himself a complete record. And one of his opinions began on the following somewhat ominous note. In dissent. Although the panel's statement of facts is accurate as far as it goes, a somewhat fuller narrative is needed to place the matter in proper setting. Well, typically after such openings, Friendly would move methodically on through the record, producing facts that the majority had ignored, drawing inferences that they hadn't occurred to them, and discrediting the witnesses on whom the majority was relying. There's an example in a dissent called Sealand Service where the district court in a maritime case had rejected a request for effectively contribution. The owner of the ship damaged in an effort to save it from further harm. A rescue effort had paid the costs of the resulting damage when the rescue effort failed, and it sought under the maritime principle of the general average contribution from the cargo owner, whom under maritime law was expected to contribute to a rescue effort, failed or not, in an attempt to save the cargo as well as the ship. And the district court, the district court had found against the owner, denying contribution, and was affirmed by the panel in a two-judge decision that was fairly persuasive until one read Friendly's dissent. It's hard to give the full sense of the opinion without more texture, but let me read briefly what he said and then translate, which he had, in a sense, did in other portions of the decision. In my view, the difficulty here has arisen because of the district court's shift from the standard it enunciated at the end of the trial, specifically whether the attempted rescue effort involving a tow that had not succeeded, but had released the ship to bang against the rocks, had increased the likelihood of the loss at issue. But the judge transferred his attention to the concept that the general average would not be available if it was more likely than not that the loss would have occurred anyway, regardless of whether the tow had been attempted. Since we all agree that the former is the correct standard, I would reverse and remand for explicit findings in regard to it. Well, it unraveled, this was his point. The district judge and the panel denied recovery because it found from the facts that there was a very good chance that the same damage would have occurred without the rescue. What Friendly understood was that the findings, in his words, had the same elusive quality of seeming to say more than they really did. They were easy to misinterpret. And what Friendly was saying in substance was that even if it was likely that the same damage would have occurred, the fact that the rescue effort increased the likelihood, maybe from 51%, to 70%, nobody could assign exact percentages, was enough to justify contribution, because the whole point of contribution was to spur reasonable rescue efforts, even if they failed. His dissents almost always had this kind of penetration, but the occasions for them really varied very widely. Sometimes the dissent was on a major issue of law or policy, where a disagreeing judge would have to express these views. But often they were on questions of fact, sometimes on not on the outcome at all, but principally to express a view that the matter was being mishandled or the party was being unfairly treated by the scope of the reversal. I think the truth is that his lightning speed made it very easy for him to dissent or disagree wherever he did. And the ordinary considerations of most judges that this might not be worth the effort and would detract from other tasks really didn't play a role in Friendly's calculus. In part, Friendly seemed to see more dimensions of a case and to be able to look further, rather like a chess player predicting the consequences of moves somewhat further down the line, when he could spy dangers and problems with a position being taken, a holding being offered, a distinction being drawn by the majority that may well have been invisible to the panel. And in some instances, he could persuade the panel, but in others, not. And along with this was this extraordinary apparatus, mental apparatus, that made it fairly easy for him to write effective dissents when he disagreed. Friendly listened carefully to other judges. He listened even to younger law clerks. But he made up his mind, as you might expect from somebody with his career, extremely fast, very decisively. And when he disagreed, he expressed it. But when you look at the dissents, there are recurring themes which, as suggested a little earlier, sometimes are evident when you look at his majority opinions, but sometimes only do they cast themselves in relief when you see them in dissents. The judge, after all, writing in dissent, is saying something he or she cares about a good deal and might have expressed in a majority opinion. But in the majority opinion, it tends to be part of the background of the discussion. When it triggers a dissent, the theme is often pointed, elaborately developed, and with a heartfelt quality that makes it stand out. And that's probably true of two of the four themes that are worth brief mention, that they would not be as obvious if you had not read the dissents. The first of the four was Friendly's unexpected, in some ways, concern with fairness in judicial proceedings, and especially in criminal cases. Because Friendly was a fairly acid critic of the Warren Court's opinions, especially in criminal area, exclusionary rule expansion, reworking of habeas corpus to turn it into a standard method to review any significant error in state court convictions. He obtained something of the reputation of a conservative, but he was not especially conservative. And his view in criminal cases, really just a matter of surprise as one reads through dissent after dissent, is how often matters that troubled him didn't trouble the rest of the court. You find this in pattern of cases that deals with the insistence on revealing exculpatory evidence, on full cross-examination, attention to the possible innocence of the defendant. Here is a typical example which illustrates him at work in an unexpected way. The defendant had been convicted in a federal district court on a single count of simple possession of 1/80, that's 1/80, 1/80 of a gram of cocaine, of an ounce of cocaine. Ordinary cocaine, not crack, kind of case is virtually never prosecuted in a federal court. But it was prosecuted in this case, and a conviction was obtained. The drug had been found in the search of the defendant's apartment. The defendant was being investigated by IRS agents who had a search warrant to look for restaurant tip violations or something of the sort, and they came across the drugs, which they turned over to the U.S. attorney. The appeals court panel, joined by Friendly, overturned the conviction on some misinstruction issue, remanding for a new trial. But Friendly dissented on the refusal of the panel to require the district judge, who had refused to do it, to conduct a hearing on a selective prosecution defense. The defense described the dubious conduct of the U.S. Attorney's Office and its threats to secure the defendant's cooperation in a investigation of his drug suppliers. Full cooperation, the prosecutor indicated, leading to the dropping of all charges and defendant's entry into the Federal Witness Protection Program. Failure to cooperate, the prosecutor warned, would be met by charging the defendant separately on each and every possible tax count available. This was too much for Friendly. Tax and drug count available. This was too much for Friendly. He dissented, asking only for a hearing to develop the disputed facts surrounding it, saying, "I recognize," it was typical of him to state both sides, "I recognize that the ability to offer leniency in return for cooperation is an indispensable tool of law enforcement. I also appreciate the undesirability of sanctioning a new defense unrelated to the merits that might require extensive pretrial proceedings, but I would want to think long and hard before deciding, after the facts had been developed, that selective prosecution initiated by information," didn't have to go to a grand jury, who would have refused, "initiated by information for a trivial offense not generally prosecuted, following conduct such as the defendant and his counsel alleged did not go beyond constitutional bounds." Another theme was that of, and this was apparent from all of his decisions, a concern with the relative competency of the institutions involved, the examiner versus the full commission, the trier of fact versus the reviewing appeals court, the court system as against Congress or independent agencies or Congress. For example, he said, I fear, in a dissent about his own court, that this is another instance where appellate judges are whetting their appetite for dealing with facts rather than leaving those to the district judge who saw and heard the evidence. This is a line running back to Thayer in constitutional interpretation and holdings, and to Frankfurter in practically everything. But it was commonly seen Friendly's opinion. It recalls, and his posture often did, Goethe's famous observation that in self-restraint the master finds his mark, not the most common pattern among judges. Running through all that he wrote next was another thread. It was an extreme attention to practicality. Partly this was temperament, partly the legacy of his law practice and corporate life. But whether he was assessing the merits of a substantive argument or passing on an evidentiary objection or framing a remedy, his feeling was that the judgment of courts really had to be anchored in the realities of the world and the consequences of the decision for getting the world's work done. If Justice Jackson is the patron saint of judges who think in this fashion, Friendly was certainly one of the most devout of the disciples. And this dissent illustrates both his enormous practicality and the role that the judgment could play in the opinion. Social Security regulations required a written application by the person seeking benefits. If you failed to file a written application at the time the benefit should have begun to accrue, you could still file one and go back 1 year to collect if you were entitled. In this case, a divorced widow applied for and received benefits for the future and for 1 year back from her application. But she also sought benefits on appeal for earlier years, claiming that when she had originally gone to the Social Security office and asked for guidance, she had been discouraged by the agency's representative, and she never filed a written application. At this earlier period, which would have protected her under this written application requirement. The Second Circuit majority found that there had been no deliberate misrepresentation by anybody. The widow had disclosed her divorce, which would prohibit her from getting Social Security until her husband died, and hadn't mentioned his death. So the agent probably correctly thought that she, on the facts she had described, she was not entitled. And the panel majority agreed that there was no estoppel by misrepresentation, a developing concept in the law at that point for the federal government. But the panel still held the agency estopped. Its theory was that an internal agency guideline, not a regulation, just a manual given to officials who represented it, had been disregarded because the manual said that agents should never discourage the filing of applications, even in dubious cases, should point out to the applicant the advantages of getting a written application on file. The widow recounted an alleged conversation which was inconsistent with this set of directives. The agent who was available couldn't remember this conversation out of thousands. Here's what Friendly wrote. By dispensing with compliance with an admittedly valid regulation which requires a written application on the appropriate form, the majority opens the door of the federal fisc, not simply to the widow, whom we know at least to have visited the HEW office and said something, but to thousands who merely will make a detailed claim that they have done so, and whom, absent the writing, there is no effective means of rebutting. Millions of dollars will have to be spent to ascertain whether conditions of eligibility claimed in a subsequent written application existed at the time of the alleged oral one. And in the same case, he pointed to a practical anomaly in the panel's own rationale, not just a policy argument against it. Clearly, it is in the public interest for an agency with over 80,000 employees making 1,250,000 disability determinations alone in a year to issue housekeeping instructions to its employees in the interests of uniform, fair, and efficient administration. But it is perplexing why an agency that issues such instructions should be held to a higher legal standard of dealing with its clients than one that does not. Friendly identified very strongly with the judicial enterprise of his intellect and his interests really cast him as a great scholar. His temperament and his drive made him a success in law practice, and his imagination and his literary skill and flair made him a very good writer. But it was this combination of somewhat dissimilar traits that in some ways made him unfitted for any one of the three pigeonholes alone. And it was judging that gave him the opportunity to combine and enhance these gifts, making them operate together. And he was eternally grateful for freeing him from what was then an extraordinarily burdensome law practice. And he reciprocated by spending a lot of time trying to make the institution work better. His concern with the effectiveness of the court system, combined with a fourth and last theme in Friendly separate opinion, but especially in the dissents, which was a remarkable fixed attention to the directive given to the lower court or agency at the end of the opinion about what to do on remand. Judges, in many cases, maybe most, having spent a lot of time trying to decide whether or not further proceedings were required and because of what error, often flag when it comes to thinking through exactly what to tell the district court to do, what issues are open, how it should go about it, whether it can hear have new proceedings. And this is, in a sense, remarkable because there's a federal statute that gives appellate panels extraordinary discretion in framing remand. It basically says, do anything you think is just if you're sending the case back. And Friendly, who had this capacity to look several steps down the road and wasn't just interested in clearing his desk of another case, was always trying to figure out what would happen next on remand. One example, although this is a major case, he disagreed with it, that a remand was necessary, but said even if it is, it's foolish because it won't lead to any change in the result. He didn't think there had been an error, but if there had been, it was harmless. Because even, he said, if Judge Carter in the district court on remand should alter his conclusion as to the issue the majority was remanding about, he would then be obliged to face the question whether New York Life acted in good faith, which is an alternative ground for the same result, and there is no doubt what the district judge would find. Looking at what would happen on the remand, he saw it was pointless, even if there had been error. It may not be an accident that several of these themes, they're not the only themes, are ones which in some measure might be viewed as looking to matters that some judges would think are extrinsic to the application of the legal rule. Concerns with fairness, relative competence, and practical effects. All might seem to some judges not central to the calculus, And a judge who took this narrow, rule-centric view of the law was one who was especially likely to draw a dissent for Friendly. Interestingly, Friendly rarely showed any satisfaction in having seen the light where other judges had failed to do so. If anything, his disagreements were flavored with a kind of frustration. It's true that, as his law clerks learned, Friendly was rather impatient with people who couldn't keep up with him. But he was generally much less likely to show this to his colleagues. And what probably explains his sharpness, asperity even, in many of his remarks, is a sense by a master of the craft that the majority is not doing a decent job, is not focusing the holding, is not discerning what's in the precedents, has not worked out what is really in the record. Now, craftsmanship is obviously much more than adornment. It's the centerpiece for this legal process theory, and in fact, using these techniques clearly does help judges to better reasoning and better outcomes, even if it doesn't determine them. Of course, the litigants and the public care mostly about the result, but one has to remember that the part of the result that governs future cases is the explanation for the outcome in the case, not the outcome itself. And conversely, a badly drafted, badly crafted opinion does, in a sense, bring some discredit on the court, and a balance ticket of unhappy examples, some of them in the Supreme Court, would be easy, if impolitic, to adduce. So if craft is so important and Friendly so much its master, why did he fail so often to persuade judges of his position? Of course, in truth, he may have persuaded them fairly often, leaving no trace in a dissent because they moved to his side. And you'd have to go through 2,800 sets of case files in order to see how often this had occurred. But still, on a three-judge panel, the judge with a strong view that the panel is coming out the wrong way needs only to attract one other vote. And given that Friendly was a moderate, that he was close, he was a legal genius, and that he was actually quite businesslike and friendly in his relations with other judges, you can't ask why he didn't succeed in more of those 200 cases. Of course, he had to fail sometimes. A colleague might be the kind of judge who responds to instinct rather than reason. Everybody is a mix. Or who lacked, had a strong allegiance to the writing judge, or who lacked the energy to re-examine a position that had earlier been taken. And Friendly's colleagues were very confident men. There was only one woman, but she was very confident too. So you might expect that the dissents would, to some extent, reflect the fact that he was, while in the middle of most panels, at the right or left of a particular one, and therefore just outvoted. But when you look at the actual data as to the judges from whom Friendly dissented, it does not support political valence as having a very significant effect. Among the writing judges from whom Friendly dissented most often were two liberals, two moderates, a conservative, and a kind of maverick who's hard to classify. Three of them across the political spectrum were Marshall at the left, Kaufman in the middle, Pratt on the right. When you turn to the judges from whom Friendly dissented at a relatively average rate, it's the same spread of political views. They were, as examples, Lombard on the right, Waterman in the middle, and Hayes probably a bit to the left. And Friendly sat on a number of cases with both a Winter and a John Newman, both and both very smart judges, and he dissented from none of their opinions. The answer must be that they were judges of a degree of intelligence and talent who at least didn't make the kinds of mistakes most likely to provoke dissents from them. Now, the general purpose and aims of dissents are familiar. They're to force a change in the majority opinion, if possible, to alter the reasoning or the result, to encourage, if this fails, an en banc, a reconsideration or certiorari, to warn uncommitted courts of the danger, to prompt legislative change, to mark the precedent as a contested one. But the dissent, as these purposes suggest, is almost always an appeal by the judge to another audience. Unlike the majority opinion. And it's well to just consider briefly the balance of advantages between the majority and the dissent. The majority, when it writes ex cathedra for the court, has a decision that controls the outcome. It doesn't need anyone's consent or acquiescence or approval. The dissent is openly advocating a position. And indeed, the judge may, in stepping down from the seeming neutrality of we've considered the issues and here's the outcome approaches, may lose a little bit of the benefit of the appearance of impartiality. Frankly, when in Supreme Court opinions, or Circuit Court opinions, the majority decides to counter the dissent with 200 footnotes explaining why the dissent is wrong, I think probably forfeits the same appearance. But the dissent is almost always in that position. But the dissenter has advantages of his own. The deployment of precedent and record evidence that the majority has overlooked, the forecast of malign consequences, the scalpel work on the majority decision. And Friendly was very good at playing offense, perhaps better than Hand. Friendly having spent years in litigation and having a toughness honed in law practice, despite a generally agreeable manner. Now, this brings us finally to saying something about Friendly's role and how one sums it up. The dissents that are called great by legal historians are virtually all those of Supreme Court justices written in great causes. And the dissents are great in some measure because they were usually prophetic and were in some fashion adopted or at least utilized by subsequent courts that came out the same way. The roll call's familiar from Curtis and Dred Scott, Jackson, Korematsu, Holmes and Gitlow, Brandeis and Olmsted, the first Harlan and Plessy. And when it comes to dissents, an intermediate judge, a court judge like Friendly with lots of mundane cases and no power to write the last word on the Constitution is necessarily not going to be of this company. If he influenced the course of the law on important issues and in a few fields like federal courts and criminal law, he probably did influence it. It may have been more through his articles than his majority opinion, and certainly more through his majority opinions than through his dissents. He was, in fact, very widely cited in his separate opinions. A quick, again, a table of run by law clerk suggests his dissents was cited considerably more often than Hand's or even Dick Posner's, who's extraordinarily prolific and intelligent in the opinion. But in the end, one's own opinions in the circuit court, one's dissents especially, have a temporary influence in the case of the majority opinions and are all subject to dissipation by time and events. Friendly's dissents, though, offer a special lesson beyond the model of great opinion writing offered by his majority positions. And here I move to a close. The story relates, turns in a sense on the potential power of a unanimous circuit court, or Supreme Court for that matter, not only to decide the case, but in a sense to control what the audience learns about the case, and so to control what criticisms can be made. In a unanimous decision, a judge observed, the victors in the case get to write its history. Against this danger, the dissent is, as Wigmore said of cross-examination, a great engine of truth. Indeed, like cross-examination, it supplies for comparison side by side with the official version, an adverse commentary, and a different outcome. You know, the phrase learning from mistakes is one familiar to every child. And while Friendly's majority opinions teach these great judicial virtues, his dissents warn against the common sins of appellate judging. Distorting or ignoring precedent, misstating the record, imprecision in thought and impracticality in the judgment, unfair or unreasonable outcomes, the failure to respect the limits of the judicial office. And of course, the sins are made vivid by Friendly's use of the panel opinion in order to illustrate. These are lessons indeed for judges, and no one needs them more. Overworked, holding positions of some authority but largely insulated from outside criticism, faced with perplexing problems that affect many lives, judges can fall easily into these sins. It's true, a quarrel does get resolved, whether rightly or wrongly, but the judges are paid to get the results right. And the lawyers know when the judges fail. This, not the dissent, is what weakens confidence in courts. So, in the end, the high office of a dissent is to lean against and check the one-sided narrative, the faulty analysis, to prompt a second look by the panel, and to warn other courts against perpetuating the panel's mistakes. In Paul Freund's enchanting phrase, the dissent is the second blade of the shears against which the cutting edge must work, serving to make a finer and truer line. So if Friendly was a prodigal in dissenting, it is our game